Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solver.
Just a reminder that this podcast is intended to be purely educational and is not meant as medical advice. Any patient information has been modified to protect the patient's identity. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers.
Enjoy the show.
Hello, hello, everyone. Welcome to another Rafael Medina virtual morning report.
My name is Yusef. I'm a PGY3 resident in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm a CP Solvers Academy member.
We're very, very excited today to have Dr. Tony Brew, who's one of the superstars in the MedEd field. And if you don't have him on Twitter, you have to follow him on Twitter right now and listen to all of the podcasts he's on. I routinely mention the tutorials on rounds to my residents and students, and he has like amazing tutorials. Dr. Brew, would you mind introducing yourself and just what advice in general would you give trainees who are interested in medicine and clinical reasoning and education?
Thanks so much, Yusef, and everyone for having me back this evening. If you're on the East Coast, depending on where you're joining, could be the morning. As Yusef mentioned, I think you mentioned I'm an internist. I work at the VA hospital just south of Boston, and I've been there for the last 10 years. And it's my third job. So, you know, this piece of advice is maybe premature for some of you, but I want you to keep it in mind as you progress in your career. And it's go someplace else. I have found that by seeing the way other hospitals, healthcare systems, and other people work and think, I have learned a tremendous amount. I think if I had stayed at the one place where I had done my residency for the remainder of my career, I may have been happy, but I would say likely would not have be as complete a physician as I am now. So go someplace else. Not right now, though. For the next hour, stay right where you are.
That's excellent. And then our case presenter today is Mark Heston. Mark is one of the superstar members of the Clinical Problem Solvers Academy. And for those who don't know, the Academy is a group who constantly joins Virtual Morning Report and enjoys medicine in general. Mark, would you mind introducing yourself?
You're too kind, Yusef. Hello, everyone. I'm Mark. As mentioned, one of the CP Solvers team members. I'm a third-year internal medicine resident at UPenn, and I'm applying for hospitalist positions next year. All right, so for our first aliquot, so we have a 66-year-old male who presented to the ED with a one-day history of jaw pain and left-sided periorbital facial swelling. So a little bit of HPI, essentially one day prior to admission, he developed this jaw pain and left-sided facial swelling. Essentially, it progressively worsened to include his left eye, and his left eye was essentially swollen shut. He was having some also photophobia and left sinus pain for 1 week, and he also had a fever of 101.1 the day prior to admission. And that's the first aliquot.
Great. So already here, we're seeing a few things, probably a few clues to what an ultimate diagnosis may be, because we have a middle to slightly older man presenting with a fairly acute onset inflammatory condition that seems to localize in a very specific place. And that's sort of the face, and even more specifically, the left side of this person's face. I'm going to spend just a minute talking about swelling and acute onset swelling, because it's sometimes valuable to think about where that swelling occurs, because there can be clues. Typically, if you have swelling in a particular site, it's because that's the site of injury. But in other situations, particularly hyperacute swelling, as you'll see in angioedema or an anaphylaxis, it'll actually go to areas that have what's called loose connective tissue. So if you think about angioedema, right, and the classic places that that goes to, right, lips, sometimes around the eyes, the genitals. Those are not the areas that you typically think about someone getting swollen when they have, for example, anasarca. Usually it's going to be the ankles, the buttocks, the legs first, and then potentially these other areas. But what's unique about some of these locations, again, sort of lips, periorbital areas, genital areas, is it has this loose connective tissue where when there's an abrupt increase in fluid movement into these tissue spaces, the resistance is less than in other spaces. And so the fluid can accumulate quite rapidly. So what we have here, and I don't think this patient has angioedema or anaphylaxis, but it's worth thinking, could one of the reasons why the edema is so severe in this location be because of the loose connective tissue? But here's, we have again, a patient with left-sided facial swelling that is involving the eye, and it also has an inflammatory component, more specifically the fever and the pain, right? So I'm going to put aside the photophobia for a moment because I'm going to assume it's related to whatever is happening in the more external areas. But if we get a sense, for example, if we get a sense that this patient becomes altered and we're worried about a central meningeal or meningoencephalitic process, then we can probably take that photophobia and think about it as something going on in the brain. But right now, I'm going to assume it's related to the edema around the eye structures. So I think in anytime you have acute onset inflammatory condition that's localized to a specific region, you're going to, at least I'm going to be worried most about an infectious cause for that acute inflammatory process in a localized region. So here, I'd be most worried about something like a periorbital cellulitis, preseptal cellulitis, or a cellulitis even potentially involving other facial structures or neck structures. So, you know, the exam is going to be valuable, but I'll be honest, depending on what the exam shows, it may be that cross-sectional imaging is going to even be more important, depending on what additional information we get and what that initial exam shows. So I'll stop there. Yusef, you may have some additional questions, but I think that's my first impression based on what we've got so far.
My question was going to be, what is the next data point that's going to help you this position with this patient? And it sounds like it's cross-sectional imaging that's most likely we're headed there.
But potentially, you know, I don't think the CBC is going to be particularly valuable. You know, the white count of 8 or 18 isn't going to sway me one direction or the other. The physical exam is going to be valuable to me because I want to get a sense for how much the eye is in self-involved and whether or not I have a decrease in visual acuity in that left eye. But it may be that what Mark's going to tell us in a little bit is that they did do cross-sectional imaging, and, you know, I don't do emergency medicine, but, depending on how sick the patient looks and depending on how bad the exam is, that may be end up being a triage point.
Yeah. Mark, back to you.
Awesome discussion. So after, you know, I spoke with the patient a little more and opened up the chart, I realized that the story didn't really start one day ago. So
it never does, right?
It never does. So this actually all started, 4 months prior to admission. The patient was doing well, but he actually developed severe right eye pain and swelling after he developed a COVID infection. And he was diagnosed with orbital cellulitis and treated with antibiotics, and this really resolved. However, then like 2 months prior to admission, he developed a left lower extremity cellulitis of his ankle, and he was treated with broad spectrum antibiotics, vancomycin, piptazo, and then he was transitioned to trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. But really, he continued to have intermittent fevers. And then a month and a half prior to admission, he presented to another neighboring hospital with abdominal pain and nausea. He got a colonoscopy that showed terminal ileitis and diverticulosis. And again, he was treated with antibiotics, ciprofloxacin and metronidazole, and discharged home. But again, he just continued to have these persistent intermittent fevers. He would say maybe once every other day or every third day. And then 1 month prior to admission, he presented again with persistent fevers. He had this truncal petechial rash and multifocal infiltrates on his CT chest. And he really told the neighboring hospital that he had a significant weight loss, about 20 pounds of weight loss since this syndrome started. And again, he was treated empirically with broad spectrum antibiotics. And he was discharged with levofloxacin for a presumed community-acquired pneumonia. But again, continue to have these intermittent fevers. And 2 weeks prior to admission, again, he presented to a neighboring hospital with these fevers. And he had bilateral eye pain, pleuritic chest pain. And this pain resolved. He was known at that hospitalization to maybe have viral conjunctivitis because there was some injection in his eyes. But again, these fevers persisted. So a little bit about his background.
But can we, is it okay, Mark, if we stop there just for a moment? Because there's a lot to chew on. And I just want to maybe put some of this, use some language around some of these findings. But just to sort of understand, he's now had both eyes involved in an inflammatory condition, diagnosed as cellulitis. Just to be clear, probably not cellulitis. He's also been diagnosed with a rash in his legs that also probably not cellulitis, later maybe becomes petechial. And then has both now involvement of the terminal ileum, colon, and lungs in the form of terminal ileitis and nodules, I believe you said, in the lung. Is that right?
We didn't have access to the outside hospital CT scan, but it was labeled, at least in the discharge summary, as multifocal infiltrates. They didn't use the terminology.
Infiltrates. Infiltrates. Perfect. And then how much weight did you say he's lost, Mark?
About 20 pounds.
Okay, great. So I'll make this brief because I think Mark wants to give us some additional history. But when you hear sort of one eye, then the other eye, one eye, then the other eye, and then particularly after you hear that there's some injection, you have to be worried about uveitis. And a lot of the inflammatory conditions that affect the terminal ileum also affect the eye. So things like sarcoid, tuberculosis, inflammatory bowel disease. And so we're getting a multi-system inflammatory condition that seems to be affecting the eye, the terminal ileum. And then if we just assume for a moment that he's got a leukocytoclastic vasculitis, it seems as though it's also potentially affecting the capillaries in the skin. And it's undoubtedly inflammatory. We're seeing fevers that are sort of not abating with antibiotics, and we're seeing weight loss. You might even say he's got consumption, right? Thinking about what affects the terminal ileum, the lung and the eye, tuberculosis historically would be, and if we were in India or Benita in the Philippines, you might say, oh, this is tuberculosis, let's go home. But let's get a little bit more information, Mark. I just wanted to sort of make those very brief comments.
Yeah, and I'll just round out. I'll just give a little bit of the background to round out this aliquot, if you wanted to loop in the background to the discussion as well. So he essentially, for his past medical history, really a rather healthy guy, just had a history of BPH. Meds he was on, gabapentin, mirtazapine, and pantoprazole. His allergies were to trimethoprim and sulfamethoxazole. I think it was a little unclear. I think he might have developed an allergy after he was prescribed that for the cellulitis, like I mentioned before. His surgery is no surgical history. For his family history, his mother had thrombocytosis of unknown etiology, and she died of vulvar cancer. His father died suddenly, unclear etiology. He has two brothers. They're alive, and they have aortic aneurysms. His two sons are also alive and doing well. No family members with any blood disorders besides the thrombocytosis of unknown etiology. And then for his social history, he volunteers in shelters for unhoused people, and he recently did extensive cleanouts and encampments. He lives with his wife. He has two dogs and one cat, he also does office work as well. And he was born in Pennsylvania, and he didn't have any recent international or other travel, and he has no drug use. And that's the end of that aliquot.
Okay, great. So I think some of the conditions that, again, can affect the eye, assuming he's got uveitis, and we haven't obviously confirmed that, but you don't usually get cellulitis, periorbital cellulitis of one eye, then jumping to the other eye and then back. Right. So this is probably not affecting the soft tissues around the eye, but it's probably affecting some of the structures within the eye. So thinking about things that can affect that can affect the terminal ileum, and that can affect the skin. Again, you might even say, let's just think about the terminal ileum for a moment, because what we have from Mark is a definitive radiographic diagnosis of terminal ileitis. We haven't diagnosed uveitis. So we just say terminal ileitis. Remember that it is a hotbed of immunologic activity. And so the things that we often gravitate towards are, again, inflammatory bowel disease, most commonly Crohn's disease. But the number of conditions, both infectious and non-infectious inflammatory, is very, very long. So tuberculosis is high on the list. Internationally, less common, I would suspect, in Pennsylvania, But as soon as you say tuberculosis, you must also invoke the question of non-tuberculous mycobacterium and then other fungal infections. And then, you know, again, I don't think you're going to see this in Pennsylvania, but Yersinia pestis can also infect the terminal ileum, among other bacterial species. And then amongst the non-infectious inflammatory conditions, I already mentioned sarcoidosis, which undoubtedly affects the eyes, the skin, and the lungs. And inflammatory bowel disease. So, you know, the reality is in a patient like this, I think confirming that he did in fact have involvement of the terminal ileum would be valuable for me. And so either, you know, I don't know that I would repeat a CAT scan, but trying to get hold of that radiographic report would be valuable, because then I could hone in on that particular site as an area of focus. And then if I'm seeing this patient in ED urgent care on the floor and his eye seems to be currently involved again, I think I can have an ophthalmologist evaluate to see, does he in fact have uveitis, would be valuable. And then finally, if he's got skin involvement now, and we'll hear about that in the physical exam in a moment, you know, early biopsy to look for a leukocytoclastic vasculitis, though nonspecific, would be valuable, because then it would at least hone me into the idea that he's got a vasculitis in the skin and likely elsewhere. And then we sort of can go on a pathway as to which vasculitis could potentially affect these myriad sites in the body.
Amazing discussion. And I was wondering, Tony, how would you want your trainees, or how are you labeling this problem, or what are you naming this problem in this case?
So I think he's got so many sites, and until we really examine him and get our own imaging, it's hard to know what's the primary focus. So the way I would probably label him right now is, again, a middle-aged to older person with a chronic inflammatory and multi-system process, with the very least affecting the eyes and the gastrointestinal tract. The lungs, I don't know yet, because he could have had an intercurrent true viral or bacterial process. We'll see if we get cross-sectional imaging. If he's got nodules now, that will change things. I can't say for certain what's going on with the skin, because we have reports, but we haven't been able to confirm it for ourselves.
And it sounded like you were thinking about the organs that have a narrower differential. And it sounded like you're also thinking about which sites we can access for biopsy or exam to hone in. Is that how you're thinking about it?
Yeah. So, you know, what's going to help us with the exam that's relatively easy? Well, I think not easy for me to do an ophthalmologic exam, but easy to get a specialist to do that. I think that doesn't require a needle. It just requires an expert. And then you're thinking about the other sites that if we identify involvement on our visit, the skin is preferred over, let's say, the terminal ileum, for example, or preferred over a lung nodule if he had one. It probably would be less specific unless he had erythema nodosum as his skin lesion, in which case, well, even that's not specific, but it would sort of clue me in to some of the diagnoses we've already mentioned. But I think the eye is going to help me understand if he's got uveitis. And then the skin is going to help me to understand, does he have a appearance of a leukocytoclastic vasculitis? And then potentially sort of going in one of those two directions for sort of next steps.
Would you be worried about immunodeficiency if those were actual infections, or you're thinking more it's rather like an inflammatory syndrome with the unifying diagnosis?
So the infections that I've mentioned, you don't need to have an immunocompromised state, right? If you think about tuberculosis as a paradigm example, right? That's the one where no matter the CD4 count, patients with HIV are at risk, right? You don't need to have a suppressed CD4 count to get it. We all wear masks in the hospital when we're caring for a patient with tuberculosis, not because we're all immunosuppressed, but instead because exposure can lead to transmission of the infection. Yeah, the same is true for other infections that can affect the terminal ileum, whether it be non-tuberculous mycobacterial infections or fungal infections. You don't need to be immunocompromised. Now, if this patient ultimately were immunocompromised, for whatever reason, that would make the probability of these infections higher and the severity greater, but they're not required.
Thank you so much. I love how you framed it. Mark, back to you.
Awesome. So now moving on to the exam and some of the initial labs and imaging. So for the exam, the vital signs, the patient was febrile to 100.9. His blood pressure was 117 over 89. His heart rate was 95. His respiratory rate was 15. And his SpO2 was 97% on room air. And as a general appearance, he was tired appearing, but he was lying in bed, no acute distress. On his HENT exam, he had some swelling under his left eye, pain on left eye gaze, but his extraocular movements were intact. He had very mild left conjunctival injection and also some left parotid swelling with tenderness to palpation, but no appreciable lymphadenopathy. His lung exam was clear. Cardiovascular exam, I didn't appreciate any murmurs. His GI exam, his belly was soft, non-tender, non-distended, didn't appreciate any hepatosplenomegaly. His extremities were warm and well perfused. I didn't appreciate any edema or any rash. His neuro exam, he was alert oriented times three and didn't have any focal neurological deficits. And then moving on to some of his initial labs and imaging, for his basic metabolic panel, his sodium was 134, his potassium was 4.4, his bicarb was 25, his chloride was 99. His BUN was 14. His creatinine was 0.83. His glucose was 95. His white blood cell count was 10.6 with a predominant neutrophilia. His hemoglobin was 8.1 with an MCV of 101. His platelets were 254. His AST was 63. ALT was 84. His total bilirubin was 0.4. And his indirect bili was 0.3. His alk-phos was 67. His total protein was 8. And his albumin was 2.7. His non-cardiac CRP was 20. His ESR was 67. He had a urinalysis, which is mild proteinuria, but no hematuria or pyuria. He had a B12, folate, and copper level, which were within normal limits. He had an HIV and hepatitis serologies, which were negative. And then he got an MRI of the head and the orbits in the emergency department, which showed an ill-defined infiltration of the left face, the left retroorbital fat extending to the premaxillary and retromaxillary fat, as well as the masticator space on the left, with associated enhancement of the involved soft tissues and left optic nerve sheath, with mild left orbital proptosis and extension of the abnormality into the left pterygoid palatin fossa and possibly the left orbital apex, and no cavitar sinus thrombosis. Because he was having, the fevers of unknown origin, and then he had prior like pleuritic chest pain, he got a CTPE in the emergency room that showed a small left side of pleural fusion with compressive atelectasis. And he also got a CT abdomen pelvis that showed an indeterminate liver lesion measuring 1.3 centimeters, otherwise no acute findings. That's the end of this aliquot.
All right. So to summarize, just using the wonderful notes that we have here, he has a mildly macrocytic anemia, unsurprising given the chronic inflammatory state. So I'm putting that aside. I don't think that's going to be a clue here. A chemistry panel that was pretty unrevealing. A liver panel that showed mild, probably chronic liver injury with an ALT and AST that are slightly above the normal. I use 40 as the normal, depends on the assay. An elevated total protein, which, I don't think he's got a monoclonal gammopathy. Probably is indicative of this chronic inflammatory state. Right? If you take that total protein, I think minus his albumin, it was pretty hardy, somewhere in the fives. And then unsurprisingly, his ESR and CRP are both elevated, sort of going along with the fact that he's got a chronic inflammatory state. He's got proteinuria, which is mild, but may suggest that not only are these other organs involved, but also the kidney, more specifically the glomerulus. And then we've got confirmation that he's got swelling, soft tissue swelling, but they're using this specific term infiltration. And so it's worth thinking a bit about what can infiltrate, right? And so if you think about starting with just the different cells that infiltrate, and just think about your CBC and the specifically the cells that are in that differential, right? Neutrophils infiltrate in the setting of acute infection, right? So could you have an acute cellulitis? Sure. And that will lead to a neutrophilic infiltration. Eosinophils infiltrate, and those are usually hyper-eosinophilic or eosinophilic disorders, whether they're primary or secondary. Monocytes can infiltrate, and when they do, we usually call them macrophages, and then they can turn into granulomas. So granulomatous diseases can lead to infiltration. And then depending on the site, we also call them other things like histiocytes. Then you've got lymphocytes, and when those infiltrate, it's usually either related to a lymphoproliferative disorder or an immune-mediated condition, something like HLH. Right. So if you think about just the CBC typically the things that we get on our differential, those are many of them. But don't forget, you've got also mast cells, which can infiltrate and cause mastocytosis. Those are sort of the way we think about basophils as they go into the tissue spaces. Then there are other things that can infiltrate. Certainly we think about molecules like amyloid molecules, whether it's transthyretin or immunoglobulin or other forms of amyloid. Specifically when you hear about retroorbital and parotid infiltration, you have to worry or wonder about something like IgG4-related disease, which can be multi-system certainly present in an insidious way like this. Some of the other things that can infiltrate probably are more organ-specific. So iron is an infiltrative process. I'm not aware of hemochromatosis affecting the parotid gland, but it's certainly another molecule that can lead to infiltration. And then certainly the storage diseases like Gaucher's disease. So if you think about what we found on the first on the physical exam and then the cross-sectional imaging, is we had actually parotid involvement. As I've already alluded to, the parotid can be involved in things like IgG4-related disease. But in my hospital, probably the most common condition is sarcoidosis. I don't see a lot of sarcoidosis, but it's known to lead to parotid involvement. And with some of these other sites involved, you do have to wonder about that as well. So in some ways, the question we're sort of going to have to tackle with is, where do we go next? Right. So Mark, if I understand correctly, he didn't look unwell. He looked chronically unwell, but not acutely unwell. But probably we're in the position, if this patient comes into hospital, that we're going to want to do our best to identify a diagnosis. And so are any of the sites of inflammation/infiltration in the head and neck area safe sites for needle biopsy is going to be one of the key questions we ask. And then if we do and we find, say, granuloma, a non-caseating granuloma, is that going to make our diagnosis? Or if we do staining for IgG4, is that going to make our diagnosis? I actually don't know if that would be enough, whether or not you'd need some additional tests. So I'll be curious to see what Mark's team ended up doing in this case. And I don't know if everyone heard this, Mark, but you heard about this case when they were in the emergency department and you were so intrigued, you demanded they be admitted to you. So I'm really curious to hear what you guys did next. But Youssef, you may have questions for me before we even get there.
No, I think my question was about what would you do next, and you already clarified that. So I think, Mark, I'm also very intrigued to what you were thinking in this moment, and what did you do?
Yes, I am definitely best friends with the veg management team at UPenn. I frequently
call them for a patient, right?
Yeah. I frequently call them each day I'm on a call and ask for patients like this. So be friends with your local veg management team. I would say one of the first things, we did, exactly what you guys were thinking, we got ophthalmology involved and say, is, you know, can you, would you guys mind taking a look at the eye and tell us if there's anything like uveitis or any, you know, ocular involvement? You know, they did their eye exam and there really wasn't any, you know, uveitis or retinal pathology or really anything that they saw on their fundoscopic exam. They noted obviously periorbital edema, and they said that honestly the eye was a little injected, like I said, but they thought that was likely just resolving maybe viral conjunctivitis, but not consistent with really with the anterior uveitis. So really during this patient's stay, he continued to have recurrent fevers. That was really the main symptom that he had. Each day he would have a fever in the morning to about, you know, 100, high 100s, 100.9 to like low 101s. And really no other symptoms. He kind of just felt unwell when he had the fevers. And, you know, obviously we ruled out the common things, why he was hospitalized, you know, acute infections, but then we kind of expanded our differential and kind of moved into a more fever and unknown origin, workup. And I'll kind of give you just all of some of the advanced labs that were obtained at the prior, outside hospital admissions that we were able to gather the first couple of days to admission, and then some other labs that we got. So kind of looking at some of the neighboring or outside hospital labs, when the patient had terminal ileitis, you know, they got an enteric pathogen panel, that was negative. Kind of looking at with a mild proteinuria, there was a 24-hour urine protein that was mildly elevated to 31 milligrams per day. There was a urine protein electrophoresis that showed no evidence of any paraprotein. The neighboring hospital got a Whipple's PCR, on the biopsy of the terminal ileitis that was negative. He had a Legionella antibodies and urine antigen that was negative. A chlamydia pneumonia IgG, which was negative. He kind of had, you know, a culture negative endocarditis workup with a transthoracic echocardiogram that showed a normal ejection fraction, no vegetations or valvular disease. And he had the serologies, Q fever serologies, those were negative. Cat scratch disease serologies, those were negative. Brucella antibodies, negative. He had a Bartonella Quintana antibodies, which are also negative. He had a respiratory, you know, pathogen panel that was negative for common cause of viral pneumonia. I mentioned his acute hepatitis panel being negative. He had light chains, which showed a normal ratio of 1.03. And he also had a serum protein electrophoresis that showed no monoclonal protein. He also had an RPR that was negative. At the outside hospital, I'm not exactly sure what prompted the testing for this, but he had a Francisella tularensis antibody IgG that was positive, but an IgM that was negative. Other things, he had a histo urine antigen that was negative and an antibody that was negative, an Aspergillus galactomannan that was negative, a beta-D-glucan that was negative, an interferon gamma release assay, which was negative, a Lyme disease, which was negative, blood parasites that was negative, leptospirosis antibodies that were negative. He had a mono screen that was negative. I think I mentioned the HIV previously. He had a rickettsial antibody that was negative, CMV negative, other tick-borne pathogens like Ehrlichia, Anaplasma that was negative, and Babesia. And obviously, you know, his blood cultures were negative at each admission and during our admission. And then he also had complements, C3 and C4, which were within normal limits. And that's the end of this aliquot.
So I think a lot of those infections were very valuable to assess for. And I'll comment specifically on the ones I have in mind. And then some of the other ones I think are valuable to assess for, not because they are high on the differential diagnosis, but rather because they are either A, highly morbid. So something like tularemia or leptospirosis, or they're highly treatable, right? And so making the diagnosis will alter your management. This presentation, and actually, Mark, remind us how many months has he been sort of dealing with this at this point? Has it been 4 months or is it now longer than that?
4 months. Yeah. That was the beginning of his syndrome. Yeah.
So if you think about the problem representation, he has a chronic inflammatory condition that's manifesting as fever and weight loss. Many of the infectious etiologies that the team looked for are probably not going to present with a 4-month process, But again, because they are either A, highly morbid, or B, treatable, I would not critique the assessment of them. But on the list of things that were looked for included fungal infections, which, as I've mentioned, can affect myriad sites, including the terminal ileum. And so histo, for example, was tested using a urinary antigen. It's curious that we test in the urine and not in the blood. And we could talk about that if ultimately the diagnosis ends up being a fungal infection, but I'll reserve comment for now. And then some assessment for tuberculosis has begun, though I'd offer that a T-spot being negative does not in any way reassure me that the patient won't ultimately be diagnosed with tuberculosis. Because he has, again, if this were the 1800s or 1700s, we'd say he has consumption, right? He's got a chronic condition with manifest by weight loss. This is consumption. And actually, a week ago, I did a clinical unknown in a young 22-year-old with no risk factors for tuberculosis who presented with consumption. And lo and behold, they had a diagnosis of tuberculosis. So never, ever convince yourself that someone doesn't have tuberculosis until you give yourself many, many months of negative cultures and multiple and a good alternate diagnosis having been identified. And obviously, we're not at a position yet where we've made an alternate diagnosis. So I think those negative tests are valuable. They don't necessarily advance the cause here, but they help us to feel more confident that a more aggressive and morbid, at least acutely morbid condition, infectious condition, isn't present. Some of these tests are also looking for non-infectious inflammatory conditions, like the complement values, but the complement's only going to be low in immune complex mediated conditions, but wouldn't be, for example, in IgG4 related disease or in an ANCA vasculitis. And so the complement levels, maybe help us to say this isn't some of those immune complex diseases, but doesn't necessarily also advance the cause. I really do wonder if ultimately what we're going to need is a pathologist's assessment using a microscope. But it could be that Mark will offer us a serologic test in the near future that'll get us closer. Youssef, what questions do you have?
I really like how you framed the testing as in highly morbid or highly treatable. My first question is, are you starting this patient on antibiotics or what are you doing for this patient when you admit them?
So I'm not going to start them on antibiotics because I'm not a fan of starting quote unquote empiric antibiotics in someone who's got a normal blood pressure. This patient presented in shock and I were uncertain, then I would probably begin them on antibiotics and let the dust settle. But here he's chronically unwell, not acutely unwell. And not only will it potentially muddy the waters if I administer more antibiotics, because he certainly had his fair share at this point, but it also may predispose him to things like C. diff. And obviously we want to avoid that.
And it sounded like you were considering some vasculitic entities. Anything in particular you're thinking about in this moment?
So this, I would imagine, would be a small vessel vasculitis. I don't know that for certain. And if so, that he's got a little bit of a fingerprint in the kidney with the proteinuria. He's got a little bit of a fingerprint in the lung. The skin seems to be uninvolved at this point. if you think about small vessel vasculitis, ANCA vasculitis, anti-GBM disease, and immune complex, so this would be the big buckets. I don't think this problem representation right now fits any of those illness groups, and so those would not be sort of my leading thoughts. Another infiltrative cause, whether it's granulomatous from an infection like tuberculosis or a non-infectious granuloma like sarcoid or IgG4, those would be a little bit higher. I'll offer that I don't think you mentioned this, but Mark, maybe tell us if you did mention it. I didn't hear a lot of lymphadenopathy on the cross-sectional imaging. And I think the paucity of lymphadenopathy would argue against some of these infiltrative conditions. Often they present with at least some lymphadenopathy. You can certainly see sarcoid without lymphadenopathy, but that's You know, and the IgG4 related disease, just to make a note, you guys probably have heard that, you know, the serum test is neither sensitive nor specific. And so we could send, we've already gotten an SPEP, but we can, and I think we heard light chains, but you, we could do subclasses. And if it's markedly elevated, that might move the needle a touch, but certainly not diagnostic.
Mark, back to you.
Awesome. A couple more labs, and then I'll introduce some advanced diagnostics. So he did have IgG4 levels that were elevated to 276. Our upper limit of normal is 123. And he also had ANCA serologies that were negative. So I talked to ENT during this admission and was like, you know, is there an area for biopsy in this like periorbital infiltrative process? And they took a look and they said, unfortunately, there really just isn't any area to biopsy. So again, you know, as the patient was during the hospitalization of the week he was there, continued to have fevers. We had this negative serological and urinary workup. So we decided to do a PET scan. So the PET scan, he had no focal FDG avid lesions suggestive of an occult solid tumor infectious process. He had diffusely increased uptake throughout the bone marrow and in the spleen and focal uptake localizing to the aortic arch. Mild uptake in the bilateral cervical lymph nodes, as well as mildly asymmetric uptake in the left tonsil. So after that, we proceeded to get a CT angio of his chest that showed mild circumferential wall thickening of the thoracic aorta and proximal grade vessels without stenosis or other vascular irregularity. And the next aliquot will reveal the final diagnosis.
All right. So, the ANCA being negative doesn't rule out a vasculitis. You recall that EGPA is the one that classically the ANCA will only be 50% sensitive. But here, he does not have an ANCA vasculitis, right? That does not affect these large vessels. So if I heard you correctly, we've got aortic arch and some of the other large vessels. Is that right, Mark? Okay. So if you think about larger vessel vasculitis. So you can either think about those that specifically affect large vessels and then the types of vasculitis that might affect vessels across different domains. And so, you know, giant cell arteritis would be sort of the classic one. And remember that the symptoms that you experience with giant cell arteritis, which when, you know, when I was a resident, we always called it temporal arteritis. The symptoms you experience are all dependent on the vessel involved. And the reason we've moved away from calling it temporal arteritis is that the temporal artery is not always involved. If you have, the ophthalmic artery involved, you may experience eye symptoms like visual loss. If you have the temporal artery involved, you may experience headache. And then if you have the arteries that feed the jaw, you may experience jaw claudication. And remember, thinking back, the patient's initial concern was for jaw pain. The fact that not all of the branches of the carotid artery would necessarily be involved here doesn't rule out giant cell arteritis. And in fact, giant cell arteritis undoubtedly affects the aortic arch as well. I'll make a note because I find this fascinating. You think about why, in this specific example of giant cell arteritis, does it affect that chain, the carotid artery and the vessels that lead off of it? There's some sense that all these vasculitides are the result of some prior infection. In the case of giant cell arteritis, Burkholderia is the infection that may be sort of priming for us, because it leads to the sort of activation of molecules in the body from the Burkholderia that also happen to appear in the carotid chain. And so the immune system, you know, some weeks, months, years after that Burkholderia infection, decide to infect the carotid artery chain. So, you know, carotid or temporal arteritis, giant cell arteritis is on the differential. And then there's other larger vessel vasculitis like Kawasaki's disease, which I don't see. I think is more manifest in younger populations. And then there are sort of moderate sized vasculitis like polyarteritis nodosa, which more commonly would affect the mesenteric arteries, but I can imagine affects larger ones as well. And then you finally, if you think about some vascular disease that can traverse large, small, medium, and everything in between, Behçet's would be sort of a classic example there. But he doesn't have Behçet's disease because you really need ulcerations, and we haven't heard anything about that. So, you know, I wonder if he's got an inflammatory, non-infectious vasculitis of the great vessels. Could he have an infectious process of the great vessels? He could. You know, syphilis we often think about as affecting the aortic arch. And if you think about, why might that be? It's because the syphilis comes in through the vasovasorum, so it happens to infect the areas that are most well supplied by the vasovasorum, and that's going to be the proximal aorta. The RPR being negative earlier doesn't rule out syphilis. I've seen at least two or three cases of syphilis with negative RPR because if you have highly active disease, that sandwich test will be negative. So that's the prozone phenomenon. So I'm not exactly certain, what the final diagnosis is in this case. I'm just looking back, his ESR being 67 is lower than you might expect for giant cell arteritis. But I'll be interested to see ultimately what Mark and his team, came up with.
Such a great discussion. So moving on. So due to this uptake in the bone marrow and the spleen, we consulted hematology and thought that a bone marrow biopsy would be really a next great step. So we got the bone marrow biopsy, and I'll read you the results. So it showed hypercellular marrow with myeloid hyperplasia, myeloid left shift maturation, myeloid cytoplasmic vacuolization, and moderate megakaryocyte dysplasia. And blasts accounted for about 4% of cellulary on the aspirate. They also had early precursors, erythroid precursors were decreased and showed cytological atypia in less than 10% of the cells. And a few early forms displayed cytoplasmic vacuolization. The myeloid precursors were also increased and left shifted with full maturation and cytological atypia. And also the myeloid precursors showed frequent cytoplasmic vacuoles. And due to just the clinical picture and the vacuolization on the bone marrow biopsy, a UBA1 mutation was sent for VEXA syndrome, which was positive. So the patient was ultimately diagnosed with VEXA syndrome.
VEXA syndrome, we had a grand rounds about VEXA syndrome at my hospital about 6 or 8 months ago. And the person making that presentation, I don't remember exactly what the claim was, but it was something on the order of 10% of the patients you've seen in the last year have VEXA syndrome. It is a highly definite. You can sort of see this tonight because I didn't raise it. It's a highly underdiagnosed syndrome, only described within the last few years. And undoubtedly one that if you haven't already seen it, you either have seen it and didn't make the diagnosis or will see it very, very soon. My sense, Mark, as you sort of learned more about the condition, you sort of came to realize, oh, my gosh, there's something to this. It is out there to be certain. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. As we were kind of doing like a cognitive autopsy on this case and kind of thinking about like how could you land to this like diagnosis? Really when we saw that, the circumferential wall thickening of the aorta and kind of labeled that as aortitis and this being like a chronic aortitis, kind of like you mentioned, then we were thinking about, okay, this is probably like a variable vessel vasculitis. And then kind of looping in another salient feature that, in the beginning, when we first saw the labs, we're like, macrocytic anemia, a lot of patients have macrocytic anemias. But then we kind of scrutinized the labs a little more, like, common causes of macrocytic anemia, B12, folate, copper, monoclonal gammopathy. So then we scrutinized that a little more, and like, what causes of like variable vessel vasculitis can also cause a macrocytic anemia. And actually what I learned is the most common manifestation, I think it's like 98% of patients with VEXA syndrome will have a macrocytic anemia. And then I finally learned that, periorbital inflammation is actually a relatively, it's about 50% of patients will develop periorbital inflammation, which definitely was not on my radar. So really taking into account those three salient features, the AR titus, macrocytic anemia, and orbital inflammation, that's kind of how I, after doing the cognitive autopsy, how you could maybe get to this diagnosis. But yeah, such a cool and fascinating and new diagnosis that, yeah, is probably very underdiagnosed.
Yeah, and thinking about my hospital, if you see a patient with an MCV over 100, far and away the most common cause is going to be alcohol-related macrocytosis plus or minus cirrhosis. But the second is going to be a myelodysplastic syndrome. Often very chronic in nature. And this bone marrow reads like that. And so I think that's what we're probably seeing here with that sort of mildly elevated MCV is a bone marrow that is has some dysplastic features to it. So Mark, just for those who are unfamiliar and those who need reminding, i.e. me, what are the five letters in VEXAS standing for? It's vacuoles, I'm almost certain, is the V, but I may be wrong about that.
It's vacuoles. I'm just going to make sure I got, yeah, vacuoles, E1 enzyme, because that's the ubiquitization enzyme that's affected, X-linked, autoinflammatory, and somatic syndrome. And this was, if you guys are interested, I could post in the chat there. It was first described in 2020, a New England Journal study of 25 men. And that was the first kind of characterization of VEXAS syndrome.
Right. So one of those acronyms that's easy to remember, but I'll be totally honest, doesn't help you at all when you're trying to identify a patient. Like none of those five things are going to be like, it's like poems. At least poems, if you remember some of those, you might remember how the syndrome presents. This you're going to have to we'll have to learn from Mark in a moment. What is the classic presentation for this? And it may be exactly how this patient presented.
Yeah, the top manifestations of VEXAS, like I said, macrocytic anemia, fever, skin involvement. It was thought that the skin involvement was also probably a manifestation of VEXAS syndrome. I would say that we were really stuck between IgG4 and then, obviously later VEXAS syndrome. But what the rheumatologist also said is that it'd be very weird for IgG4 disease to kind of having this remitting course of, skin involvement. And that was the one thing that maybe didn't really fit as well for IgG4 disease. And then also, VEXAS syndrome can also cause pulmonary infiltrates. It causes like a neutrophilic alveolitis. It can cause arthralgias, ear and nose chondritis, and DVTs and Ps as well. And a really important thing to remember of VEXAS syndrome is that, as well as really, I'll read this quote, and it's on a schema that I found on Twitter. Is that essentially the rheumatologist said VEXAS, a new disease hiding out in patients with diagnosed with relapsing polychondritis, polyarteritis nodosa, giant cell arteritis, Sweet syndrome, MDS, and multiple myeloma. So you really should search for one of these other hematological or inflammatory conditions when you're thinking about VEXAS syndrome.
It's really remarkable, and this will be my final comment. Unless Yusuf drags something else out of me. Every sort of generation has a couple diseases that are born alongside them. For me, I can remember IgG4, seeing that the first time I saw that diagnosis was as a third-year resident in a patient with retroorbital proptosis. And I had never heard of it before. I think it had been fairly newly described. And so every generation has those. This is first described, as Mark is saying, just 4 years ago in 2020. So this is one of yours. So you want to own this and feel very, very comfortable with it because it was born the same time as many of you were born as clinicians. So for me, again, IgG4 was a big one. HLH to some degree too. That began to explode in the early 2000s. It's always been around, but...
Thank you, Tony. I think that was very, very poetic. So I think it would be very nice to end on a poetic note, the diseases that we're going to grow up with. Mark, thank you so, so much. The chat is asking for you both, like, when when are Mark and Tony going to come back again? But really, really happy to have you both. I hope you have a wonderful afternoon.
And, that's a wrap, take care. Folks. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
If you like this episode and want more from the Clinical Problem Solvers, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter that includes episode recaps, teaching points, and educational graphics.
And if you'd like to join us live, check out our daily virtual morning reports, where we come together as a global community to discuss cases and learn together. For more information and instructions for signing up, check out the link in the episode description.
See you next time.